The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have a lot to share. The latest on health and healing, why your genes may not be the predictor we've been led to believe of your potential for disease. Then, commentary, where liberals go to feel good, from truthdig.com, Chris Hedges. Also, commentary on food speculation. People die from hunger while banks made a killing on food, from John Vidal, from The Guardian. And finally, Chris Crom on 1 year after Citizens United. What does it mean? Now, I'll also give you our latest environmental update on the dangers of bone cancer from fluoride in your toothpaste and your drinking water. You have not heard this. This will be an exclusive. And I won't have time for calls because we have so much to cover. So let's begin. First up, we have been told for the last 15 years it's in your genes. You're an alcoholic, you're a drug addict, you're unemployed, you're overweight, you're depressed. It's in your genes. Many of us have said that's not so, that we have been able to alter the impact of any weak genes or defective genes by lifestyle modification. Here is the latest. This is from Science Daily, research done at Duke University Medical Center. And here's what they have to say about this. This was published in Nature Genetics. Quote, despite what you might have heard, genetic sequencing alone is not enough to understand human disease. Researchers at Duke University Medical Center have shown that functional tests are absolutely necessary to understand biological relevance of the results of sequencing studies as they relate to the disease. Quote, right now the paradigm is to sequence a number of patients and see what may be there in terms of variants, unquote. In lay language, it simply means that you have been oversold. You have been promised that all that was necessary is wait for the magic drug that would rebalance your gene, that would correct its defect, all the while not making any mention that a healthy lifestyle and a healthy attitude in and of itself has been shown to correct genes. So, once again, they were way behind the curve. And also, the U.S., according to Mike Adams, the USDA has been found poisoning bird populations and causing mass die-offs. Now, this is the first we've heard about this, but this is worth quoting. It's a short piece, and it says, not all the mysterious bird die-offs that have been witnessed around the globe recently are due to unexplained causes. A recent mass die-off event witnessed in Yankton, South Dakota, was traced back to the USDA, which admitted to carrying out a mass poisoning of birds. After hundreds of starlings were found dead in the Yankton Riverside Park, concerned citizens began to investigate. Before long, a USDA official called the local police and admitted they had poisoned the birds. Quote, they say they had to poison the birds about 10 miles south of Yankton, and they were surprised they came to Yankton like they did and died in our park. That's according to the animal control officer there. The USD then confirmed the story and explained that it was, quote, all part of a large killing in Nebraska. Some of the birds that ate the poison apparently flew all the way to Yankton before succumbing to the poison. Well, then this gets to the larger issue. Who knew the USDA was killing lots of birds? So why was the USDA poisoning birds in the first place? A Nebraska farmer was apparently complaining that the starlings were defecating in his feed mill. The answer to this conundrum, apparently isn't to cover up your feed mill, but rather call the USDA and ask them to poison all the birds. The USDA complied, apparently agreeing that this was a brilliant idea. So they put out a poison called DRC-1339 and allowed untold numbers of tens of thousands of birds to feed on that poison. Carol Bannerman from the USDA Wildlife Service ridiculously claimed that the bird kill was also to protect, quote, human health. Quote, we're doing it to address, in this case, agricultural damage, as well as the potential for human health and safety issues. Well, excuse me, that's just a lie. In what universe do starlings pose a threat to human health and safety? Are these people completely delusional? Do they think we're all idiots? The USDA even has a name for this mass poisoning program, Bye-Bye Blackbird. Through the use of poisons such as DRC-1339, the USDA has killed over 4 million birds. Yeah. So that's our USDA in action. Now, something that the people in this audience are aware of, because I've produced several films, including The Drugging of Our Children and Prescription for Disaster, both of which are highly critical of that part of medicine that is not scientifically based, to the contrary, has no proof of efficacy and actually shows harm. And that's in comparison to that part of medicine which is important, that can and does save lives, and that I certainly support, mainly emergency medicine. But that's only about 10% of medicine. 90% of medicine in the United States is for chronic care, and we fail miserably there. Not only do we fail miserably, but we then end up causing what is known as iatrogenesis, or medically induced illness or death. It is so bad that over a period of 5 years, we wrote a definitive paper on this that has been widely quoted that showed that the number one cause of death and injury in the United States every year, year in and year out, is not cancer, stroke, heart disease, diabetes, it's iatrogenesis, or medically induced. So many have died needlessly, preventatively, that if you took the last 10 years, it would be over 6 million people. And I referred to it when you kill 6 million people that had no reason to die, that's medical genocide. Anyhow, I sent out the report to every single medical organization, the AMA, I sent it to every federal agency, sent it to universities. No one responded to it. As if, let's don't touch this, let's not open this door, because we might get drug into some debate on it. In any case, one of the areas I'm most critical of is the psychiatric diagnostic procedure. I have said, and I have confirmed it with dozens of psychiatrists and scientists, that there is no scientific basis for the diagnosing of mental illness. That does not mean people don't suffer from delusions and hallucinations and psychotic behavior. They certainly do. What it means is that the way that the scientific, or I should say the psychiatric community, has defined mental illness, virtually every person on the planet could now be diagnosed as mentally ill. And then I got behind the scenes. I found people who actually knew how do they come up with these diagnoses, like social anxiety disorder or math defiant disorder. We don't like math, and suddenly you're psychiatrically diagnosed. It's all a game. And now, this is something that's come out just today, and I'll quote this. Quote, there is no definition of a mental disorder. It's bull S. I mean, you just can't define it, unquote. Who said that? Dr. Alan Francis, MD, lead editor of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual No. 4. And as the DSM-4 is the imperial doctrine used by psychiatrists in diagnosing mental disorders, prescribing powerful psychotropics to the masses, having over 10 million of our children use these every day. When I was growing up, no one used it. And of course, having the consequences of mass killings and suicide, and getting paid for it, this is quite a confession. Quote, we made mistakes that had terrible consequences, unquote. From the same Alan Francis, lead editor of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. This is from Monica Young. Quote, Gary Greenberg, who interviewed Francis and wrote an in-depth article for Wired magazine, described how Francis conscious has been hitting him in the gut. Quote, diagnosis of autism, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, and bipolar disorder skyrocketed. And Francis thinks this manual inadvertently facilitated these epidemics, and in the bargain fostered an increasing tendency to chalk up life's difficulties to mental illness and then treat them with psychiatric drugs, unquote. And by the way, the DSM-4 led to a 40 times, that's 4,000% increase in child bipolar diagnosis and an epidemic of dangerous antipsychotic prescriptions for children as young as 6 months of age. And senior editor of the previous edition of the DSM-3, Robert Spitzer, MD, had his own rude awakening. He is one who spurred Francis to join him in battling against the creators of the DSM-5, the next edition in progress. And Spitzer, MD, publicly censored the American Psychiatric Association for mandating that psychiatrists involved in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual No. 5 sign a written promise to never talk about what they are doing except when necessary for their jobs. Quote, the intent seemed to be not to let anyone know what was going on, says Dr. Spitzer. Now, Spitzer and Francis both warn that including a proposed, quote, pre-psychotic disorder could lead to a new diagnosis explosion and drug company marketing onslaught. Francis says an emphasis on early intervention would encourage, quote, the wholesale imperial medicalization of normality, producing a, quote, bonanza for the pharmaceutical industry, while imposing on patients, quote, the high price, adverse effect, dollars, and stigma. In effect, they want to be able to determine, are you potentially at risk of having a mental disorder, which they in turn will define, of which there is no science to back it up. There's no blood chemistries, and there's no x-rays. There's no DNA analysis. It is pure, pure fantasy. Yet, could you imagine how many people they would preventatively determine and then come to your house and say, we have determined from a study that you, a questionnaire you answered, that you are capable in the future of being depressed, so we are mandating that you take these prescription drugs now. Sound out of the way? Sound impossible? No, not at all. Now, mind you, these are two of the top people who worked on this, coming out of the closet and saying something. And this is the first time you've heard this on any radio program in the United States. Quote, lacking medical research, the DSM-5 website is riddled with deliberately discussing how the experts agree. Well, how they agree is they get around a table and they say, okay, this is actually how it works. We think that if someone talks back to authority, that's really a brain abnormality, that's brain chemical abnormality, and let's call that authority defiance disorder. Let's see hands. Okay, we got six hands. So be it. As of today, no one will challenge this. Every court in America must accept it. You can be involuntarily incarcerated. You can be held against your will. You can be forced to take medication because we just voted in a new mental illness. And that's happened year in and year out for the last 30 years. And so now with this new edition coming out, it will virtually be impossible for any American not to be diagnosed. Every single person on the planet now could be diagnosed with a mental disorder, which would then be supported by the court system, which would then be controlled by the medical pharmaceutical doctrine that you will be detained, medicated for your own good, preventatively, so you don't commit any social issue in the future. It's for your good. You heard it here first. Remember, this is happening now. This is not science fiction. And in a moment, we'll show you something else that's not science fiction that ties in with what I said the other day about how quickly we're becoming a nation without the freedom of choice. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Together, just
do. I'm Gary Knoll. In a moment, several commentaries. But first, something that I thought you would like to hear, and then I will work my commentaries off of it. We'll be joined in studio by Steve Lopez, our social media director, in a moment to also discuss some of this. Listen up right now to a clip from the Rachel Maddow Show.
But we begin tonight with a tale of two speeches, both from the same man, both from President Obama. One speech that could have been billed as a ballad to the Constitution, a proclamation of American values, a repudiation of the lawless behavior of the last presidential administration, and another speech announcing a radical new claim of presidential power that is not afforded by the Constitution and that has never been attempted in American history, even by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. Remarkably, President Obama today made both of those speeches simultaneously. Standing inside the National Archives in front of the actual original Constitution, President Obama delivered a blistering critique of the Bush administration, in which he called their actions and their legacy literally a mess.
Our government made a series of hasty decisions. Poorly planned, haphazard approach. Too often, we set those principles aside as luxuries that we could no longer afford. Our government made decisions based on fear rather than foresight. The decisions that were made over the last 8 years established an ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable.
An ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism that was neither effective nor sustainable. Ouch. Then, moments later, he announced his own ad hoc legal approach for fighting terrorism. President Obama today proposed something new, something called prolonged detention. Doesn't sound that bad, right? Prolonged detention. Did you ever see the movie Minority Report? It was based on a Philip K. Dick short story. It came out in 2002. It starred Tom Cruise, remember? He played a police officer in something called the Department of Pre-Crime. Pre-crime is where people are arrested and incarcerated to prevent crimes that they have not yet committed.
Mr. Marsh, by mandate of the District of Columbia Pre-Crime Division, I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Dubin. That was take place today, April 22nd, at 0800 hours, 4 minutes.
No, I didn't do anything.
You didn't do anything, but you're gonna. Future murder. Creepy, right? Putting somebody in jail not for what they've done, but for what you're very sure they're going to do?
There may be a number of people who cannot be prosecuted for past crimes. In some cases, because evidence may be tainted. But who nonetheless pose a threat to the security of the United States.
We're not prosecuting them for past crimes, but we need to keep them in prison because of our expectation of their future crimes.
Al-Qaeda terrorists and their affiliates are at war with the United States, and those that we capture, like other prisoners of war, must be prevented from attacking us again.
Prevented. We will incarcerate people preventively. Preventive incarceration. Indefinite detention without trial. That's what this is. That's what President Obama proposed today, if you strip away the euphemisms. One civil liberties advocate told the New York Times today, quote, "We've known this was on the horizon for many years, but we were able to hold it off with George Bush. The idea that we might find ourselves fighting with the Obama administration over these powers is really stunning." And it is stunning, particularly to hear President Obama claim the power to keep people in prison indefinitely with no charges against them, no conviction, no sentence, just imprisonment. It's particularly stunning to hear him make that claim in the middle of a speech that was all about the rule of law.
But we must do so with an abiding confidence in the rule of law. Our government was defending positions that undermine the rule of law to ensure that they are in line with the rule of law.
How can a president speak the kind of poetry that President Obama does about the rule of law and call for the power to indefinitely, preventively imprison people because they might commit crimes in the future? How can those two things coexist in the same man, even in the same speech? Well, that brings us to the self-consciously awkward, embarrassing part of this speech today. After condemning the Bush administration for what he called their ad hoc legal strategy, for trying to make things seem legal that patently weren't, this is what President Obama proposed.
my administration has begun to reshape the standards that apply to ensure that they are in line with the rule of law. We must have clear, defensible, and lawful standards for those who fall into this category. We must have a thorough process of periodic review so that any prolonged detention is carefully evaluated and justified. Our goal is to construct a legitimate legal framework for the remaining Guantanamo detainees that cannot be transferred. Our goal is not to avoid a legitimate legal framework. In our constitutional system, prolonged detention should not be the decision of any one man. If and when we determine that the United States must hold individuals to keep them from carrying out an act of war, we will do so within a system that involves judicial and congressional oversight. And so going forward, my administration will work with Congress to develop an appropriate legal regime so that our efforts are consistent with our values and our Constitution.
You'll construct a legal regime to make indefinite detention legal. You will, what does he say? Develop an appropriate legal regime. So you can construct a whole new system outside the courts, even outside the military commissions, so that you can indefinitely imprison people without charges. And you'll build that system from scratch. What's that somebody said about ad hoc legal strategies? Just for context here, in the United Kingdom, where there isn't even a Bill of Rights, there's been a major debate about whether people can be held in preventive detention. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair wanted 3 months to be the outer limit for how long anyone could be held. There was a big political fight about it. Parliament ended up limiting that power to 28 days. 28 days is still the longest period of preventive detention that's allowed under law in any comparable democracy anywhere in the world. How long would President Obama's proposed preventive indefinite detention last? Well, he's not saying yet, but here's how he defines the threat that he says makes indefinite detention necessary.
Right now, in distant training camps and in crowded cities, there are people plotting to take American lives. That will be the case a year from now, 5 years from now, and in all probability, 10 years from now.
10 years from now. So you can get arrested today and locked up without a trial, without being convicted, without being sentenced for, say, 10 years until the threat of your future criminal behavior passes. Prolonged detention, he's calling it. This was a beautiful speech from President Obama today with patriotic, moving, even poetic language about the rule of law and the Constitution, and one of the most radical proposals for defying the Constitution that we have ever heard made to the American people.
That was Rachel Maddow. Now a few of my own thoughts. Right in front of us, through the Bush administration and now the Obama administration, we have seen individuals who have committed multiple acts against the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, against our personal freedoms. Because take away the word Al-Qaeda and substitute anyone representing a threat, and that is in the Patriot Act, that is in the Homeland Security Act. And then look at the actual documentation of actual spying and arresting of Americans. Were they Al-Qaeda supporters? No. They were environmentalists. They wanted to have healthy food. They were protecting the right to grow food organically. They wanted the right to take our supplements. They wanted the right to choose a physician. Yet time and again, what they choose to define as someone, an individual or group, as being a threat, they then have the right to do it. And then their oversight is a group of people who are completely in alignment with them. So where is the independence of this? Let us take a little trip back into history for a moment. It was 16 years from the beginning of the Revolutionary War until the Bill of Rights. A lot of people are confused about the timeline, and I see it all the time on some of the other stations where they talk about we should be more like the founders of the Constitution and the writers of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. We should have their character. Well, first, we don't. The people today who really are true patriots in that they care about the rights for all people and do not define a right as being better for one group other versus another. They believe that a right should exist for all people. That was not true of all the signers of the Declaration of Independence. As we all know, many of them had slaves. So I immediately have to challenge that part. But then they were radicals. It is my contention that any of the major signers of the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution or any of the other particulars would today be monitored or arrested or considered an enemy of the state, a provocateur. Now, in 1774, the First Continental Congress met in Philadelphia from September 5th to October 26th. They didn't represent all the colonies, all but one, but there were 12 colonies there. And it was Patrick Henry, who was a real firebrand. Patrick Henry today would not be belonging to either the Democratic or Republican Party. He would definitely be considered so independent in his thoughts. He would be more of a libertarian. He said, "I'm not a Virginian. I'm an American." And that's when they began to act as a United Nations for the first time. And in July 4, 1776, the Declaration of Independence, which stated to hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, unless they put, unless you're a woman, and unless you're black, or unless you're Latino, unless you're Native American, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. By the spring of 1776, many colonists from New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland opposed seceding from England. And others wanted to cede. There was a great deal of vitriol and enormous hostility in language between these groups. Some wanted to stay under the monarch. Others did not. And Jefferson wanted immediate action, but they said, wait for 3 weeks so that the delegates could return from this conference and share their ideas with their populations. And on July 1st, they said, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for the people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume," and then it went on, "we held the truth to be self-evident." Well, they debated for 4 days, and then they became free of Great Britain. In 1786, the war was over by 5 years, and then we saw our rebellions. Now, mind you, these were real rebellions. The first major one was Shays' Rebellion. And it showed that they needed a new constitution. And Massachusetts Captain Daniel Shays led an uprising in western Massachusetts where farmers got together from September 26th to 28th, and they took over a courthouse. And why'd they do this? Because the people who were then in power were corrupt. They were engaged in unfair trade, unfair taxation, and many of the people who were former farmers were also former soldiers and had fought in the Revolutionary War. And they said, "What are you becoming? You're becoming as bad as England." And indeed, we were. This is a little part of history that Glenn Beck and others seem to have forgotten. And that's where we ended up in 1787 coming up with the Articles of Confederation that governed the new U.S. Laws. And they wanted the states to have some sovereignty, because up to that point, even though they had a constitution, the states still did not honor the fact that they could not act on their own. And so they were, in effect, a United States, but acting independently. And so it was left up to James Madison, who today would be considered so radical, that he would be under constant FBI surveillance, Homeland Surveillance. He created the three divisions of our government, the ones we have today. And he did so with the idea that keep each one separate so that no one branch dominates. And that was crucial. And today, look at what we have. The intent of dominating. The Democrats just dominated the House, the Senate, and the executive branch. That means that they went in defiance of what all the founders wanted, a separation. They also did not want church and state. And yet, from Clinton to Bush to Obama, you have the religious incentive. You have this federal money funding religious institutions and their foundations. Those institutions then meet on a regular basis and dictate what becomes policy for legislators, left and right. And then we had the revision of the Constitution, and with the chair being George Washington, in September 17th, delegates approved the Constitution. The preamble was, "We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice and ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare and security." Now, when it says promote the general welfare, to me that means you're looking after the needs of people, many of whom could not look after their own needs. Hence, I would have assumed that our government would have thought that it was the right thing to do if we had a universal health care to help those who could not be insured. It's in the Constitution. But be that as it may, they look at it in their own way. And then they ended up with seven articles that followed that broke the government into its different positions, gave it its authority. The third article, the judicial power, setting up the Supreme Court and lesser courts. And the fourth, the each state must be equal and to all other states. And the fifth, the procedure for amending the Constitution. And the sixth, making the Constitution the supreme law of the land, unless you're a member of CODEX, unless you're a member of the World Health Trade Organization. And suddenly, making the Constitution the supreme law of the land is usurped by the world governing body of the World Trade Organization, a completely commercial and secret organization that works in secret to determine trade. And that usurps our Constitution. And then the seventh, the ratification of the Constitution. So anyhow, then you had a group of people who were so terrified of the idea that this bemoaneth could control all the laws and all of our rules, that you had a group that were called the Anti-Federalists. Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, even Thomas Jefferson was very concerned about that. And then you get to your Bill of Rights. And this is where it really gets important. Those Bill of Rights were meant to protect us. You know, the if you look at the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. Unless you assemble in Lafayette Park, walk across the street to the White House and say that you're going to stay there, and then they come out and they arrest you, as they recently did. All of the people who were engaged in nonviolent, peaceful demonstration to redress the government. Well, isn't the First Amendment specific in, quote, redressing government and the right of assembly? Unless you're in this modern era of tyranny, and which you can't. And how about the force securing a person in their house? Well, unless now a cop can stop you and take your cell phone and download your messages, and they can confiscate your computers out of your house, and they don't have to have any of the types of search and seizure procedures from the past, because Homeland Security has made it a universal principle that there are no rights to the individual. We have not, even with the constitutional present, we do not have an establishment, reestablishment of habeas corpus. So when you look at each of the Bill of Rights, the right to a speedy trial is the Sixth Amendment, and the ability to confront your witnesses and an impartial jury. Well, how is keeping someone detained who you believe may be guilty of making Americans or our government look bad or corporations bad by demonstrating in front of a hardwood forest that a corporation is going to tear down, and now you're arrested because they feel that you may be a threat? So now anyone from any organization that represents any outspokenness that embarrasses or affects the government or corporations is now falling under that Homeland Security Act and now is a target. And a Freedom of Information document shows that we are all being watched. And yet, where is the outspokenness against this? So if the people today like Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity truly believe that we should be in some way aligning ourselves with the ideals of our founding fathers, then to protect the rights of the citizens, then shouldn't they be the ones in front of the White House getting arrested? Shouldn't they be the ones who are testing the strength of their own convictions by stopping home foreclosures, demanding food that go to the poorest in America, the 50 million Americans who are on food stamps, instead of building more military bases in Afghanistan? I haven't seen any of those demonstrations. I haven't seen Glenn Beck getting arrested. I haven't seen Sean Hannity at Bear Rally getting arrested. But I see them acting like great oracles because they have an audience that watches them. And all they had to do is look It's 1793 when the Fugitive Slave Act occurred. I mean, we had slaves here from 1619 when the first slaves arrived. Article 4, Section 2. Any slave that escapes in one state must by law be returned to the owner from another state. Well, how fair is that? 1794. The Congress passes the 11th Amendment protecting states' rights. So you see, we have a long history of advised consent and challenge. Where is that challenge today? And finally, this is a commentary from Chris Hedges. I'll cite this and then we will come back to our issue. Because every time I suggest that we could have a very viable, independent, progressive movement of people who no longer align themselves as Democrats or Republicans, both of whom we all should be aware now are purely corporatists, with few exceptions, and that we're the majority. We're 44% of the population, but we're not organized. I'm told, well, but you know, it's better to be a Democrat and look for, or be a Republican and look for reform. And I said, there is no such thing as reform. Show me a single act that has been reformed, act that has led to any transformation, that has led to power back to the people, that has led us to benefits to the people. Show me one. You can't. Now, Barack Obama is another stock character in the cynical political theater embraced by the liberal classes, according to Chris Hedges. Quote, Act One is the burst of enthusiasm for a Democratic candidate who, through clever branding and public relations, appears finally to stand up for the interests of citizens rather than corporations. In Act Two, it is the flurry of euphoria and excitement. Act Three begins with the befuddled confusion and gnawing disappointment, humiliating appeals to the elected official to correct mistakes, and pleading with the office holder, return to yourself, your true self. Act Four is the thunder and lightning scene. Liberals strut across the stage in faux moral outrage, delivering empty threats of vengeance. And then there is Act Five. This act is the most pathetic. It is as much farce as tragedy. Liberals frightened back into submission by the lunatic fringe of the Republican Party, or the call to be practical, begin the drama all over again. We are now in Act Four, the one where the liberal class postures like the cowardly policeman in The Pirates of Penzance. Liberals promise battle. They talk of glory and honor. They vow not to abandon their core liberal values. They rouse themselves like the terrified policemen who have no intention of fighting the pirates with the bugle call of forward. This scene is the most painful to watch. It is a window into how hollow, vacuous, and powerless liberals and liberal institutions, including labor, the liberal church, the press, the arts, the universities, and the Democratic Party have become. They fight for nothing. They stand for nothing. And at the moment when we desperately need citizens and institutions willing to stand up against corporate forces for the core liberal values, values that make a democracy possible, we get the ridiculous chatter and noise of the liberal class. The moral outrage of the liberal class, especially of MSNBC, groups such as Progressives for Obama and MoveOn.org, is built around the absurd language of personal narrative, as if Barack Obama ever wanted to be or could defy the interests of Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, or General Electric. The liberal class refuses to directly confront the dead hand of corporate power that is rapidly transforming America into a brutal feudal state. To name this power, to admit that it has a death grip on our political process, our systems of information, our artistic and religious expression, our education, and a successfully emasculated popular movements, including labor, is to admit that the only weapons we have left are acts of civil disobedience. And civil disobedience is difficult, uncomfortable, and lonely. It requires us to step outside the formal systems of power and trust in acts that are marginal, often unrecognized, and have no hope of immediate success. The liberal class's solution to the bleak political landscape is the conference. This, alone with letters and cries of outrage circulated on the internet, is its preferred form of expression. Conferences, whether organized by Left Forum, Rabbi Michael Lerner, or figures such as Ted Glick, who is touting a plan to lure progressives, including members of the Democratic Party, into something he calls a third force, are where liberals go to feel good about themselves again. These conferences are not fundamentally about change. They are designed to elevate self-appointed liberal apologists who seek to become advisors and courtiers within the Democratic Party. The conferences produce resolutions no one reads. They build networks no one uses. But with each conference, liberals get to do what they do best, applaud their own moral probity. They make passionate appeals to work within systems such as the electoral politics that they have been gamed by the corporate state, and the result is to spur well-meaning people towards useless and ultimately self-defeating activity. Quote, what we need is an alliance which consciously incorporates elected Democrats as well as elected Greens and Independents, as well as groups and individual leaders and members of groups like Progressive Democrats of the American Green Party, so says Glick. Well, good luck. The organizers of the Left Forum Conference scheduled for this March at Pace University in New York also communicate in the amorphous, high-blown moral rhetoric that is unmoored from the actual and real. The upcoming Left Forum Conference, which has the vacuous title Towards a Politics of Solidarity, promises, quote, to focus on the age-old theme of solidarity, the moral act of imagination underpinning working-class victories everywhere. The conference agenda, which sounds like a parody of a course catalog description, includes the requisite academic jargon of moral act of imagination and change of solidarity. This language gives to the enterprise a lofty but undefined purpose, and this is a specialty of the liberal class, to grandly say nothing. The last thing the liberal class intends to do is fight back. Left Forum brings in a few titans, including Noam Chomsky, who is always worth hearing, but it contributes as well to the lethargy and turpitude that have made the liberal class impotent. In conclusion, the only gatherings worthy of attending from now on are acts that organize civil disobedience, which is why I will be at Lafayette Park in Washington, D.C. on March 19th to protest the 8th anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Veteran groups on March 19th will also carry out street protests in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago. Either we begin to militantly and stand against the coal, oil, and natural gas industries, or we do not. Either we defy preemptive war and occupation, or we do not. Either we demand that the criminal class on Wall Street be held accountable for the theft of billions of dollars from small shareholders whose savings for retirement or college were wiped out, or we do not. Either we defend basic civil liberties, including habeas corpus and the prosecution of torturers, or we do not. Either we turn on liberal institutions, including the Democratic Party, which collaborate with these corporations, or we do not. Either we accept that the age of political compromise is dead, that the corporate system of powers are instruments of death that can be fought only by acts of resistance, or we do not. If the liberal class remains gullible and weak, if it continues to speak to itself and others in meaningless platitudes, it will remain as responsible for enslavement as those it pompously denounces. Unquote. That is Chris Hedges. I'm Gary Knoll, and that's just a look at some of the things, because it's from this that one day you wake up and realize, why can't I eat organic? Well, because all the small organic farmers have been put out of business. Why can't I buy my supplements? Well, because Codex was implemented April 1st, 2011 in Europe, and now we follow suit. Didn't you read it? Oh, why can't I have my doctor be covered by using chelation? Oh, because that's not a part of the orthodox medical model. Why must my child take this test and determine if they have mental illness preventatively? Oh, like the movie with Tom Cruise, we want to make sure that there's no mental cases out there that are not diagnosed. Why can't I go in and see the person that's been arrested because we're protesting from the White House? Oh, because, you know, they're a serious threat and you can't. They'll be in there forever without due process. And so it goes. So you wonder how it all connects? It does. All you have to do is look. To continue in this line of thinking, let me mention that I believe that the commentary I just did represents the views of not just one individual, one of our brightest individuals, a truly progressive individual who has put himself online, been arrested for those views, is probably on everyone's target list in Washington, but also I also sense his sense of frustration. Whereas I last year was a part of the Liberal Forum, in fact, this year I'm also going to be a part of it, and many other progressives, both conservative and liberal, will be a part of that. So I believe that I understand his frustration, and I also understand where he may believe that nothing ever comes from these meetings, I've seen that just the opposite is true. I've seen that a great deal of cooperating between individuals, and from there, investigative reporting, articles, various forms of demonstrations, sharing information. So I would share a different point of view than Chris Hedges on saying that these meetings and these groups are of no value. I believe they are of value, but I share a difference with him. Also, I'd like to state that there are conservative progressives, those that are not the pro-war, neocon, reduce government at all costs, get rid of deregulations. They don't believe in that. They do believe that the states, the federal government, and the local economies should be more intelligent and reasonable in how they go about expanding their budgets and having services that really serve the interest of their constituents and people living within their means. And on that level, I certainly support that. That's my own background, being financially conservative. I don't buy what I can't afford. I don't believe in living on debt. To assume that debt is an asset is an illusion until one day you wake up and you've got the bills. And then look at the value of what you thought you needed. It's plummeted, and yet you have to pay the bills. And then on the other side, we have those liberals who are more aligned with the Democratic ideology, but then there are liberals who are very progressive. So it's rather ironic that we have conservative and liberal progressives, aside from the rank-and-file liberal, the rank-and-file conservative, or Democrat or Republican. That said, let us now go to a commentary from Danny Schechter. It is called, Is Fascism Lurking? And Danny represents one of those real liberal progressives. Fascism is one of those words that sounds like it belongs in the past, conjuring up as it does marching jackboots in the streets, charismatic demagogues like Italy's Mussolini or Spain's Franco, and armed crackdowns on dissident movements and freedom of expression. It is a term we are used to rereading over and over again in our histories about World War II, not, however, in news stories about present-day America. And yet the word and the dark reality behind it is creeping into popular contemporary usage. Radical activists on the left have never been hesitant to label their opponents with the fascist word. Whenever government supports laws that limit opposition or overdo national security or abuse human rights, government paranoia turns critics paranoid. One example, writer Naomi Wolf forecasts fascism creeping into America during the Bush years, accelerated by the erosion of democracy. She said, quote, "It is my argument that beneath our very noses, George Bush and his administration are using time-tested tactics to close down an open society. It is time for us to be willing to think the unthinkable. As the author and political journalist Joe Connison has put it, that it can happen here." Wolf feared Americans couldn't see the warning signs. Quote, she says, "Because Americans like me were born in freedom, we have a hard time even considering that it is possible for us to become as unfree domestically as many other nations. Because we no longer learn much about our rights or our system of government, the task of being aware of the Constitution has been outsourced from citizens' ownership to being the domain of professionals such as lawyers and professors. We scarcely recognize the checks and balances that the founders put in place, even as they are being systematically dismantled. Because we don't learn much about European history, the setting up of a Department of Homeland Security, remember, who else was keen on the word homeland, didn't raise alarm bells it might have," unquote. By the way, that other person was Adolf Hitler. Now those bells are now being rung by John Hall, an outgoing Democratic congressman from upstate New York. His fear of fascism has less to do with repressive laws and militarism than the influx of corporate money into politics, swamping it with special interests that buy influence for right-wing policies and politicians. Quote, "I learned when I was in social studies class in school that corporate ownership or corporate control of government is called fascism," he told the New York Observer. "So that really is the question, is that the destination if this court decision goes unchecked?" Well, reports New York Observer, quote, "The court decision that he is referring to is Citizens United, the controversial Supreme Court ruling that led to greater corporate spending in the midterm elections, much of it anonymous. In the wake of the decision, Democrats tried to pass the Disclose Act, which would have mandated that corporate donors identify themselves in their advertising, but the measure failed amid GOP opposition. Ads from groups with anonymous donors were particularly prone to misleading or false claims. Hall said the influx of corporate money in the wake of Citizens United handed the House of Representatives to Republicans. Quote, fascism should be more appropriately be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. Many in mainstream politics who understand that big money can dominate elections, although not in every case, share Hall's fears. In California, two well-known female candidates from the corporate world raised tens of millions of dollars, but still went down in defeat. So money alone is not the be-all and end-all of a shift towards a red, white, and blue brand of fascism. Other ingredients are needed, and some may be on the way, like economic collapse, defeat in foreign wars, rise in domestic terrorism, and the emergence of right-wing populist movements that puts order before justice and wants to crush its opponents. Some argue we must have these movements, such as the Tea Party, although other critics focus on the rise of the Christian right that promotes fundamentalist politics in the name of God. The Tea Party is not just about Democrats, and it has started a campaign against the liberal Methodist Church. In fact, it is not internally democratic either, with no elected officials or officers or set of bylaws. It seems to be managed and manipulated by shadowy political operatives and PR firms, financed by a few billionaires who support populism to defang it. Already militias are forming because of fears of immigration, and there's also concern that if unemployment remains high, there is likely to be more violence, with police forces understaffed because of government cutbacks. Gun sales went up after the recent violent incidents in Arizona. The erosion of economic stability, with the rise of foreclosures and the shredding of social services, is already turning a financial crisis into a social crisis. We already have sharp partisan divide and inflation of hateful rhetoric, with vicious put-downs of the president and condemnations of members of Congress, calling them corrupt, even traitors. According to set the characteristics of fascist nations, there is, quote, a disdain for the recognition of human rights. And because of fear of enemies and the need for security, the people in fascist regimes are persuaded that human rights can be ignored in certain cases because of need for security. The people tend to look the other way or even approve of torture, summary executions, assassinations, long incarcerations of prisoners. In place of human rights, enemies are turned into scapegoats as a unifying cause. The people are rallied into a unifying patriotic frenzy over the need to eliminate a perceived common threat or foe. Racial, ethnic, and religious minorities, liberals, communists, socialists, all become terrorists. This process is already far along in the United States. Among the classical characteristics of fascism is a shutting down of debate and a focus on the state, which in our country is controlled by lobbyists and private interest. Wall Street and the military-industrial complex have far more clout than elected officials. In the past, during the Depression, there was a plot to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It was exposed and neutered. Could something like that happen again? Maybe it doesn't have to. What with hawks already in control of Congress, major media outlets, and the military, and poised to slash the power of unions and curb progressive social programs, including public education. Some writers believe that if and when fascism comes to America, it would be packaged in a friendly form tied to beneficial advertising slogans and public interest messaging. It'll be sold to us. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening. Have a nice day.
There's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find to bring some love in here today.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Carol Lee.